Stone reviewed the information quickly, then handed each of them a cardboard file. "These files," he said, "contain a transcript of autoclock records of the entire flight of Scoop 7. Our purpose in reviewing the transcript is to determine, if possible, what happened to the satellite while it was in orbit." Hall said, "Something happened to it?" Levitt explained, "The satellite was scheduled for a 6-day orbit. On the second day, it went out of orbit." They studied a transcript of moment-by-moment communications between Mission Control at Vandenberg and link-ups at Kennedy Space Center, Sydney, Australia, and Grand Bahama, all routed through Houston. The transcript included reports of a mysterious system malfunction and the decision of Mission Control to bring the satellite down. Several passages in the transcript had been deleted. Hall said, "What about the deleted passages?" "Major Manchek at Vandenberg told me," Stone said, "that they had to do with Russian craft in the area. The flight eventually concluded that the Russians had not either accidentally or purposely brought down the Scoop satellite. No one has since suggested differently." They nodded. "It's tempting," Stone said. "The Air Force maintains watchdog facility in Kentucky that tracks all satellites in Earth orbit. It has a dual function, both to follow old satellites known to be in orbit and to track new ones. Now, the important thing is that, Russian or not, there are a hell of a lot of satellites up there. As of last Friday, the Air Force reported 587 orbiting bodies around the Earth.
So a collision with a piece of junk is possible?"
"Yes, possible."
"How about a meteor?"
"That is the other possibility, and the one Vandenberg favors. A random event, most likely a meteor."
Levitt cleared his throat. "There is still another possibility."
Stone frowned. He knew that Levitt was imaginative and that this trait was both a strength and a defect. At times, Levitt could be startling and exciting. At others, merely irritating. "It's rather far-fetched," Stone said, "to postulate debris from extra-galactic source other than..."
"I agree," Levitt said. "Hopelessly far-fetched. No evidence for it, whatever. But I don't think we can afford to ignore the possibility."
A gong sounded softly. A lush female voice, which Hall now recognized as that of Gladys Stevens of Omaha, said softly,
"You may now proceed to the next level, gentlemen."
Level 5 was painted a quiet shade of blue, and they all wore blue uniforms. Burton showed Hall around.
"This floor," he said, "is like all the others. It's circular, arranged in a series of concentric circles, actually. We're on the outer perimeter now. This is where we live and work. Cafeteria, sleeping rooms, everything is out here. Just inside is a ring of laboratories. And inside that, sealed off from us, is the central core. And that's where the satellite and the two people are now."
"But they're sealed off from us?"
"Yes."
"Then how do we get to them?"
"Have you ever used a glove box?"
Burton asked. Hall shook his head. Burton explained that glove boxes were large, clear plastic boxes used to handle sterile materials. The boxes had holes cut in the sides and gloves attached with an airtight seal. To handle the contents, you slipped your hands into the gloves and reached into the box. But your fingers never touched the material, only the gloves.
"We've gone one step further," Burton said. "We have whole rooms that are nothing more than glorified glove boxes. Instead of a glove for your hand, there's a whole plastic suit for your entire body. You'll see what I mean."
They walked down the curved corridor to a room marked Central Control. Levitt and Stone were there, working quietly. Central Control was a cramped room stuffed with electronic equipment. One wall was glass, allowing workers to look into the adjacent room. Through the glass, Hall saw mechanical hands moving the capsule to a table and setting it down. Hall, who had never seen a capsule before, watched with interest. It was smaller than he had imagined, no more than a yard long. One end was seared and blackened from the heat of re-entry. The mechanical hands, under Stone's direction, opened the little scoop-shaped trough in the side of the capsule to expose the interior. "Our next step," he said, "is to determine whether there is still anything in the capsule which is biologically active. Suggestions?"
"A rat," Levitt said. "Follow with a rhesus," Burton said.
Stone put his hands back on the controls, moving them gently. Through the glass, They saw the black metal fingers move to the far wall of the adjoining room, where several caged lab animals were kept, separated from the room by hinged, airtight doors. The wall reminded Hall oddly of an automat. The mechanical hands opened one door and removed a rat in its cage, brought it into the room, and set it down next to the capsule. The rat looked around the room, sniffed the air, and made some stretching movements with its neck. A moment later, it flopped over onto its side, kicked once, and was still. It happened with such astonishing speed, Hall could hardly believe it had happened at all.
My God, Stone said. What a time course.
Next, Stone directed the mechanical hands back to the wall, opening another door and withdrawing a cage containing a large brown adult rhesus monkey. The monkey screeched as it was lifted and banged against the bars of its cage. Then it died, after flinging one hand to its chest with a look of startled surprise. Stone shook his head. Well, at least we know it's still biologically active. Whatever killed everyone in Piedmont is still there and still as potent as ever.